Want to be protected from opinions you don't like? Then you better go somewhere else, because this is not a safe space. This is American Viewpoints with Mike Ferguson.
We've had what's probably the first round of robust debate and argument over how to handle this recent trend, this recent fad of gender dysphoria and so-called transgender treatment, if you will. Well, that was the first round, is what should governments do? Some states have outlawed it. Some states have had different degrees of discouraging it. And now we've got maybe the next wave of the entire issue, and that is the legal aspect, the lawsuits of people who have gone through this, realized that they've made a mistake, and now they're angry at the people who did this to them in the operating room or in the doctor's office. So I found an interesting article, you could find it at The Hill, called Here Come the Gender Detransitioner Lawsuits, and it was written by Dr. Merrill Matthews of the Institute for Policy and Innovation, who joins me right now. And Dr. Matthews, thank you so much for being on the program here, because we've got multiple layers to the discussion. There is the argument over whether this is biologically factual, whether this is medically necessary. And then you've got the policy issue as to what freedoms should be allowed for people to do this, especially with minors. But now when you put in the civil lawsuit aspect of this, you're adding another layer. So maybe nobody's going to go to jail, but there is now a legal consequence if somebody says, I should have never had this done to me. When you say, here come the gender detransitioner lawsuits, what is it that we're seeing right now so we can predict maybe what's coming ahead?
Well, it's a good question, Mike. Thank you for having me. I was talking with Jordan Campbell the other day. He's an attorney. He had left a large law firm and started a specializing small law firm handling just detransitioners. And I thought, this is interesting, because he's not a trial lawyer. He's not somebody who's going out and chasing ambulances. That wasn't part of his business. But he found out about this, and it spoke to him, and he found a couple of other partners. And so they're the first law firm set up to just handle detransition lawsuits. There's a few other groups that have been doing this, but I think there's maybe nearly 10 cases out there, 10 lawsuits out there against against both the healthcare, the doctors, and the healthcare centers where these procedures took place. And we're seeing increasingly in the media articles from people who worked at these places and others, and they came up and said, you know, I felt like we really weren't treating these kids right. They come, many of them have mental health issues, and they don't treat the mental health issues very well. They just simply sort of encourage them to move forward. You must be somebody who aligns with the opposite gender that you were born at birth, and encourage them to move on with the lawsuits. With the care. And that has become a problem, because as some of these minors have reached adulthood, 18, 19, 20, they're looking back and they may not be able to have children. They've had irreversible surgeries that have affected their lives, their own medications that will affect them the rest of their lives. In some cases, if they've just taken puberty blockers or hormones, they may make them infertile. So it's really a mess for these kids. And they feel like, you know, I was just going through a transition in my teen years or my early teen years, and now it's affected my life from now on.
In some states, the laws have been changed, some to make doing this to minors criminally liable. But in other states, they've passed laws that specifically say you're allowed to sue later in life, and they've kind of sidestepped the criminality aspect of it. What role do those specific laws that say here's the superhighway to sue, what is that changing, if anything, when it comes to this sort of gender dysphoria transition industry that's emerging?
As far as we've seen so far, it hasn't changed much. What we've seen is the people who provide this gender-affirming care, as they call it, have been pushing back. But there have also been articles out, and one came out not long ago where they said, where they're recognizing that, well, we initially didn't think there would be really any detransitioners, but now we see that, in fact, there are some detransitioners, and we're sympathetic with this. But the vast majority, they're saying, are still going to be very, very happy with this. I don't know that that's going to be the case, because this has been such a recent phenomenon. The number of people who were essentially seeking this care tripled between about 2017 and 2021 or so. And you have to look at this and say, well, this is not a contagious disease. Why would you have the number of kids saying, I think I may identify as the opposite sex, triple in just a few 4 or 5 years? I think it's a social contagion. And because of that, I think fad may not be the right term, but it's something that kids catch on to, and it sort of seems cool to do that. But once you go further, you get into areas where you can never roll that back. And so about half the states, I think, have passed laws. Judges have blocked some of those. They've let some of the other laws go forward. We'll have to see where that plays out. But and that's why I suggest that I think the real pushback here may come if some of these lawsuits are successful.
We are visiting with Dr. Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation, and you can find his article, Here Come the Gender Detransitioner Lawsuits, at The Hill and also at IPI's website, which we'll give out here in just a moment. One of the pushbacks, I'm going to guess, and I'm not a lawyer, Dr. Matthews, but they're saying, hey, these are elective surgeries. By definition, these are elective. It's not a matter of you were being brought in with a heart attack and we had to do something to clear out the arteries. This is completely elective. So why should we as a medical community or doctors or surgeons worry about being liable for what's an elective procedure?
See, I think that's the most interesting question. And on background, I spent 10 years as the medical ethicist at a medical school's, what we call the Institutional Review Board for Human Experimentation, where you have to approve all the human experiments. And so I've been interested in medical ethics for a number of years. And I have hip replacements, so I have to have, when I go to the dentist, I have to take amoxicillin. And so I was talking to a dentist here a while back. And he said, he checked, did you take your amoxicillin? I did. And I said, just out of curiosity, if I hadn't taken that, because if you don't take it, the threat is that you could get an infection if a dentist is working in the gums and so forth. If I hadn't taken that, would you still go ahead and do the care? He said, absolutely not. I would not provide any care. We'd have you come back. And I said, well, if I gave consent, if I said, yes, it's okay, I'm an adult, I give you consent, go ahead. He said, no. And he said, here's why. There was a case where a patient came in to a dentist. He had not taken the amoxicillin. He wanted the dentist to go ahead and do the procedure. The dentist said no, pushed back. Finally, the patient kept saying, look, I'm an adult, I give you consent. You have no liability here. So the dentist went ahead and did it, ended up with the patient got an infection. He sued the dentist and he won. And I said, how did that happen if he gave consent? He said the jury's reasoning was the dentist was the medical professional. He had the knowledge. He should have known that he shouldn't do that, even if the patient was trying to give his consent. So I'm thinking that something like that may play in here where families, minors with maybe even parental consent and so forth say, you know, you really knew better than this and you did not, you went ahead and provided this care anyway, even though what I needed was mental health care rather than physical health care. And so I think something like that mentality may play here.
All right. We've got a minute or so left here real quick. So does that mean to some degree the ideologies, and you mentioned the social contagion, which is what it certainly looks like from the numbers, is it likely that that could be sort of put on civil trial with these lawsuits being allowed to move forward? Because, again, we're not talking about criminal trials in many states.
I think absolutely that's what's going to happen. And I think, my sense, Mike, is in 5 or 10 years, maybe 5 years, will sort of push back and think, what in the world were we thinking when this, when we were allowing this to go forward? It's you're seeing in Europe a number of countries that had tried to embrace these gender transitions are beginning to push back and say, you know, we really should not be allowing minors to make these decisions. If they become adults, fine. But if you're still a minor, we need to hold off on this and make sure that this is something they really want to do, because I think we're going to have a lot of regret coming up here, and that's going to sort of force these, if juries are listening to these minors talk about what's happened to them, I think they're going to be very sympathetic.
And where do we find out more about what you're doing and what the Institute does? What's the website, social media to be in touch?
They can go to IPI.org. The piece is posted at IPI.org, or they can go to thehill.com and put my name in there and detransitioner, and all that will pop up.
All right, Dr. Merrill Matthews from the Institute for Policy Innovation, thank you so much for being on the program. We know that the debate isn't anywhere near being over. This is going to be fascinating and crucial.
Thank you.
And once again, that website is IPI.org. I'm Mike Ferguson. Thank you for making American Viewpoints part of your weekend. We'll talk to you again next week.